This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
I'm Connor Reed with Words to That Effect. Stories of the fiction that shapes popular culture. Sasquatch, Bigfoot, the abominable snowman, Yeti, the Yowie, the Yeren, the Almas, apemen, cavemen, wild men, the missing link. The idea of the missing link came about in the mid-19th century with the rise of Charles Darwin's theory of evolution. In 1859, Darwin published his book On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, and it was radical, revolutionary, and highly contentious. The problem, though, was that the mechanism by which it all worked wasn't really understood yet, and there was a need for some hard evidence that would clinch his theory. If evolution really did work as Darwin described it, if, most controversially of all, humans, chimpanzees, gorillas and other apes all had a common ancestor, it should all be there in the fossil record. There was a missing link in the theory. Well, actually, there were lots of missing links, and they weren't really links because that's not how evolution works, but we'll come back to all of that. For now, the hunt for the missing link was on.
So he postulated then the missing link as the one thing that would really conclusively prove his theory. The theory being that we are all descended from a common ancestor. So if you could find an intermediate form, a fossil of an intermediate that showed that there was a transition period when an organism had the characteristics of two completely different species, that would prove the theory.
Professor Virginia Richter.
Okay, so my name is Virginia Richter. I'm a professor at the University of Bern in the Department of English. And my special interests are Victorian and modern literature, and in particular also the connections between literature and science.
This was a period when plenty of exciting paleontological finds were being made. Dinosaur bones in particular, as I'm sure you know all about from listening to episode 25. And then, just after Darwin's Origin of Species, there was a key discovery, Archaeopteryx.
That was discovered in a quarry in Bavaria in 1861, so just 2 years after the publication of The Origin of Species. This fossil or this combined the features of reptiles and birds. So it looked like a reptile, but it had feathers on it. So it would have been really a very timely discovery proving or supporting Darwin's theory. But of course, immediately there was a huge controversy about that. There was a dispute between Thomas Henry Huxley, who was, of course, Darwin's most staunchest supporter, and Richard Owen, who was the most famous anatomist of his day and also an antagonist of evolution theory. And Owen said, no, this is not a missing link in the sense of combining the features of two species, but it's just an early kind of bird, so a primitive bird. And so this controversy went on for quite some time.
A bird-like dinosaur was one thing. For most people, though, it was the human fossil record that was the most fascinating and controversial aspect of evolutionary theory. The idea that we share a common ancestor with other apes, that there had been any number of other human-like species living both before and alongside our ancestors. The first of these fossils had been found just before Darwin's work in 1856, in a small river valley near Düsseldorf in Germany. The area was being quarried for limestone when some very unusual human-like fossils were uncovered. News of the discovery spread rapidly, such that you already know the name of this small valley of the River Düssel, Neanderthal.
So that was 1856, and that these were discovered by chance. And then again, the same thing happened, that we had a very intense debate between scientists. So what did these bones signify? Now, are they really forms of a primitive human, so a humankind's ancestors, modern man's ancestors? Or were these skeletons just deformed by some illness? Why is this a strange shape? Is that a freakish occurrence? Does it actually nothing have to do with human ancestry?
The debates continued, but this was to be the first of a number of discoveries in close succession across the second half of the 19th century.
And then there was the German follower of Darwin, Ernst Haeckel, who had postulated, taking up Darwin's ideas, who had postulated the idea of the pithecanthropus. So that is a hypothetical link between apes and humans. And it was then Eugène Dubois, a Dutch medical doctor who had read both Darwin and Haeckel, and also Alfred Russel Wallace's Malaya Archipelago.
You have to feel sorry for Alfred Russel Wallace. Independently to Darwin, he discovered the theory of evolution by natural selection. Darwin was a far more central figure in the scientific establishment, and he'd been working on the idea for far longer, but he hadn't actually published anything yet. So when he realised that Wallace had been working on the same idea, in the end, both of their papers were presented together. Ultimately, though, it was Darwin whose name went down in history. Anyway, that's Alfred Russel Wallace. We were talking about Eugène Dubois and his search for the missing link.
And he was fascinated by this search for the missing link, and he had the idea that the tropical zones would be the best place to look for the missing link. So inspired by Russell's The Malaya Archipelago, he just had himself posted as a doctor to Java and spent his time there looking for these fossil bones, and was then in the end successful. So that was the Java man, or what he called the Pithecanthropus erectus, today called the Homo erectus. So that was another of these series of discoveries that then went on in the 20th century, and that gradually really showed that humankind had developed from an ape-like creature, so that Darwin was right.
Java man, later Homo erectus, was, as the name suggests, erect. They had shorter arms and longer legs and stood more upright, similar to modern humans. And they were the first human ancestors to spread outside Africa. And they lived a very long time, from about 2 million years ago until around 250,000 years ago. Us Homo sapiens have only been around for about 300,000 years. And so, as new human ancestors were discovered, more Neanderthals were found over the decades as well, a pop culture image grew around these missing links. For the most part, early 20th century depictions of Homo neanderthalensis, the Neanderthal, or Pithecanthropus, were of brutish, dim-witted cave dwellers. Lots of hair, big clubs, animal skins, you know the idea. And they started popping up in lots of works of early science fiction and in adventure tales, from H.G. Wells to Arthur Conan Doyle to Edgar Rice Burroughs. And these ideas have changed and been updated a lot in recent decades, especially with regards to the intelligence of early humans. But the brutish Neanderthal image is now so well established that it's kind of hard not to think of them this way. So missing links were all over popular culture in this period.
Popular fiction and fiction in general was really very quick to pick up Darwin's ideas. And of course, it's exactly this idea of the missing link was something that lends itself to adventure fiction. So you have loads of texts, many of them forgotten now, but some are still being read that pick that up.
The beauty of the missing link is that it's missing, which means it's a puzzle. It's something that can be solved, something that can be found following a quest in an adventure novel, or it's the missing link in a mystery tale. In reality, in evolutionary terms, the idea of a missing link is a little bit misleading. It implies that evolution is a chain and that this single missing link will restore continuity connecting one part to another. But in Darwin's famous image of the tree of life, evolution is like a continually branching tree. It's not a single unbroken chain. You know that very, very famous image? It has maybe five types of human. There's an ape, and then there's a more upright ape, and then there's a sort of a caveman type image, and then a sort of modern man or something along those lines. That really, really famous image. It doesn't really illustrate how evolution works at all. But these sort of images and the missing link images is much easier and it's much more powerful and it's much better for a narrative. So that's the idea that has stuck around. I did an episode recently on Jekyll and Hyde, number 35, if you want to have a listen. And this is one of so many stories from this time that were heavily influenced by all of these ideas of missing links and human ancestors.
Perhaps one less obvious example is Stevenson's strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Of course, Mr. Hyde is described also as, and he's swarthy, so he's very dark, he's small, he is bent over, he moves very, very quickly, he's very strong. He has a. He's very hairy. His hand is very hairy, and Mr. Utterson, the detective character in this story, also describes him as troglodytic. So Mr. Hyde is clearly associated with both the human ancestry and with the ape. And of course, that is particularly nice analysis of this anthropological anxiety, because of course Mr. Hyde is. The alter ego of Dr. Jekyll. So this apishness and savageness are lurking inside the civilized Englishman and are always in danger of erupting.
This idea of so-called savageness lurking inside the civilized is at the heart of Tarzan too, who I talked about two episodes ago. Arthur Conan Doyle, the subject of episode two, is another important author in this regard. Wow, these episodes are really tying in very nicely together. And actually, while I'm talking about all these episodes, if you've been enjoying them, maybe you'd like to consider supporting the show on Patreon. If you're like Nick, the latest wonderful and kind patron of the show, then you could be listening to bonus episodes right now and feeling all smug about yourself for supporting all the work that goes into making this show. So head to patreon.com/WTTE for more. Secondly, before I return to all these strange human-like creatures, I wanted to talk about some far sexier beasts. That is to say, I want to recommend the podcast Sexy Beasts. Resident comedians slash cryptozoologists Tony Cantwell and Mark Jago work through some of the world's weirdest creatures week by week. All the greatest ape men have had appearances, from Bigfoot and Yeti to Yowie and the Sheep Squatch, not to mention Selkies, Trolls, the Capilobo, the Jabafofi, and plenty, plenty more. Listen wherever you're listening to this right now for some very good cryptid entertainment. Now, back to Arthur Conan Doyle and his missing links. So, as I've said, it's not a coincidence that missing links from paleontology are found alongside detective fiction. There's a central mystery to both. In fact, Arthur Conan Doyle was actually a suspect in a famous forgery case of this period, the Piltown Man. So this was a discovery made actually quite near Doyle's home in Sussex, and it was claimed and believed to be a new and really important paleontological find, one to rival the Java Man. It was finally uncovered as a forgery in the 1950s, and while Doyle was never really strongly considered as a suspect, it was very tempting to look at the creator of Sherlock Holmes as a potential suspect in this devious crime.
Yeah, I'm clear. Arthur Conan Doyle would be a very good example, because he was very interested in these theories. So he had this theme also in some of the Sherlock Holmes stories, for example. The Adventure of the Creeping Man. The Creeping Man is a professor who starts to behave very strangely. And as Sherlock Holmes finds out, he was taking a medicine to rejuvenate himself, because he'd fallen in love with a younger lady. And this medicine was made of monkey glands, and it had the effect of making him so to revert, yeah, to become ape-like and animal-like. So this is one example from detective fiction. Conan Doyle also was, he had this other series of novels, the Professor Challenger novels, and the best known of them is The Lost World, where and there's an expedition under the leadership of this Professor Challenger going to South America, and on an isolated plateau they encounter actual ape men. So exactly these surviving missing links, who are very uncanny because of the similarity, or because they are both human and ape at the same time. So that's really something very, very frightening.
And yeah, this is what's important. It is frightening or uncanny. Lots of these missing links or ape-human hybrid stories had elements of horror, because there was plenty that was disturbing or unsettling about this whole idea. There was lots of anthropological anxiety, as Dr. Richter terms it.
This fundamental category crisis that followed from Darwin's theory, so the anxiety about, or the uncertainty about human status, this questioning of the unique quality of the humans, also the fact that human superiority was called into question by common descent and by this theory of the evolutionary origin of the higher faculties, and also this loss of a divine plan. So instead of God planning everything for us and salvation beckoning in the end, we have this really messy and contingent trial and error method of evolution. So all of these things really put into question this certainty that humankind is the superior species and that nature is something that is distinct from humankind. Yeah, humankind are, the human body is still is part of nature, but there is a realm within the human that is clearly not part of nature, that is actually somehow under divine control. All of these things, that is what I refer to as anthropological anxiety.
That uncanniness, that realization that humans are not all that distinct, is really apparent, I think, when you watch other apes, chimpanzees, gorillas, orangutans, something that is obviously fairly commonplace for many of us now, given the prevalence of zoos. In the 19th century, though, zoological gardens opened to the public. This was a very new concept. Dublin Zoo, just down the river from where I'm recording right now, was one of the very first, actually, opening in 1831. And while chimpanzees and orangutans were a bit more common in zoos around this time, the gorilla remained a mystery until well into the 20th century. There had been alleged sightings and vague descriptions, but really only a very, very small handful of Westerners had actually seen gorillas in the wild in the 19th or even early 20th century. Very little was understood about gorillas, and there were plenty of myths and misconceptions about what they looked like, how they acted, how human-like they were. Much like the numerous other ape men and missing links, from Bigfoot to the Yeti to whatever local variation you care to choose, it seems that wherever you are in the world, there's a story of a mysterious ape-like human lurking in the woods or the mountains. We are obsessed with stories of ape-human hybrids by early types of humans and species that blur the boundaries between us and our ancestors.
I think, partly these are just great adventure stories. but I think what drives us is also the question who we are, right? And what does it mean to be a human? What is the limit of the human? And you can explore that by looking at figures that are similar to humans, but not quite the same, right? So they are kind of, apes, yetis, but also machines, artificial intelligence that cannot be distinguished from humans. I think they have the function of showing us a mirror, but also maybe there's something that you take out, something that is different. In artificial intelligence, it's the emotional quality that is lacking. So something is lacking. And then you can always ask the question, is this one thing, is that the thing that is specifically human? So I think that's one possible answer to that. I think it's also the quest for the last things that remain somehow unknown, because science has progressed so far that if you think again about back to the 19th century, how much was not known then, and what scientists could discover then, and it seems much more limited today. So I think they can think of, okay, there is still this one area that is mysterious that we need to find out something about. So I think that's also something that triggers interest in these kinds of stories.
Our knowledge of Bigfoot has not, unfortunately, advanced much in the last half century or so. But our understanding of apes and of our evolutionary ancestors very much has. Literature and culture has come to reflect that too, especially in the ways we now think about ape intelligence.
And so I think in literature, we can see a very significant shift from modernism onward, where rather than being figures of horror and menace that needs to be exterminated, we find sympathy with apes, because apes now come to represent unity with nature that humans have lost. So to become an ape in the 19th century, that was something terrible or a great danger. In the 20th century, it becomes like becoming a human. For an ape to become a human is a tragedy, because they lose this unity with nature. I think the most prominent early example is Kafka's Report to an Academy, where a speaking ape addresses an audience and tells the story of his how he became a speaking human, but it's not a happy story. We have many stories that describe apes as lab animals, zoo animals, and in more recent literature as an endangered species. So there is also concern about apes, and they are giving a really prominent figure in contemporary literature where they appear as really central characters.
There are lots of contemporary stories with apes at their center too, and I asked Dr. Richter for a modern recommendation.
In contemporary literature, I really liked Colin McAdams' A Beautiful Truth. That was a very beautiful story about a chimpanzee who is adopted as a baby by a human couple and grows up as their child. But then things go wrong when he grows up. So that was a really well-written book that I enjoyed reading.
In cinema, TV, and other media too, ape-human hybrids are everywhere, constantly being reinvented and reimagined, from King Kong to Tarzan to Planet of the Apes, for example. So, in the end, there is no missing link as such. But Darwin's theories were correct, and our understanding of our own origins has advanced massively since his famous publication. And yet, there's still so much we just don't know about our own species, about our own past on this planet. Which is fine. Scientists will keep uncovering more, and fiction will keep filling in the blanks in new and entertaining and fascinating ways. That's it for another episode of Words to That Effect. Thank you so much for listening. Special thanks this week to my guest, Professor Virginia Richter. I have included links to all of her work and her bio on the website, which is wttepodcast.com. If you head there, you can also check out pictures and links and all of the previous episodes and lots of other lovely things. You can sign up for the newsletter if you like. You can also follow Words to That Effect on Instagram and on Facebook, and I'm on Twitter at CEDOREID. So get in touch, say hi, and I always welcome suggestions for new episodes. I had one just the other week, which is in fact going to be the next episode. So get in touch. Music this week was by Blue Dot Sessions. And finally, if you'd like to support the show, head to patreon.com/WTTE. That's it. I'll see you in 2 weeks for another episode.
This podcast is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network.